This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an archaeology project is telling an amazing story of Native American history in Wisconsin, and it's finding the evidence under the lawns of Trempealeau.
First, Wisconsin cheesemakers are expressing serious concerns over a decision made by the Food and Drug Administration this week.
Wooden boards, which have been used by cheese producers around the world in the aging process, were called unsanitary by the FDA after the agency cited several New York operations for using them. Despite state laws that permit the process, the move could spell the end of wooden board aging nationwide.
Here with us to talk about the FDA's decision and what it could mean for Wisconsin is Jeannie Carpenter. She's the director of the Wisconsin Artisan Cheesemaker Guild. Jeannie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why is the FDA upset about using wood boards to age cheese?
Well, for the past many, many years, the FDA has left it up to different to the states, really, to enforce cheese aging on woods. And recently in New York State, last week actually, they decided that all of a sudden that wooden boards are no longer sanitary to age cheese on. And not only have they decided this for New York, but for the entire country. And also beyond that, they've now said that no cheese being imported into the United States aged on wooden boards should be allowed either.
Well, give us a little 101 here. Why do cheesemakers use wooden boards? What do they get out of that?
Well, cheese has been aged on wooden boards for, centuries, especially in Europe. Wood is used primarily because it imparts flavor. You know, there's a reason why certain French and Swiss, Italian cheese appellations, like Gruyere, Comté, Parmesan Reggiano, they actually require specific species of wood when aging wheels of cheese. When you don't use wood, the flavor, the texture, even the composition of cheese changes. I mean, even the difference in the air circulation from resting wheels on wood versus plastic or metal can influence a cheese's taste. So cheesemakers had figured this out a long, long time ago. And it's been safe for a long time, and so we're wondering what's changed.
And this is legal under Wisconsin state law. How widespread is it? How much cheese is made with this method?
In Wisconsin, it's estimated between 20 and 30 million pounds of cheese are being aged on wood. And this is, this is from cheesemakers really small, just making a few wheels a year, to bigger cheesemakers making thousands and hundreds of thousands of cheeses a year. Cheesemakers from small to large have figured out that cheese tastes different and some would argue better when aged on wood.
What are you hearing as far as reaction from cheesemakers around the state?
Well, everyone's sort of in this sense of disbelief right now, and it's quickly going from disbelief to high levels of distress. There's cheese factories who have built specific aging facilities underground, to state and FDA regulations where they are aging cheese on wood. And they're really concerned that the time and the investment that they've put into these facilities is going to be lost if the FDA decides that wood or if it enforces that wood is indeed illegal.
You mentioned that plastic and metal might come up with a different taste, a different kind of cheese. Is there an alternative to using the wood that the FDA is apparently banning?
No, they're not stating any sort of alternatives. They're just stating that wooden shelves they're saying that they're a porous material, and so anything that is in a cheese factory or cheese aging facility must be a non-porous material and must be adequately cleaned and sanitized. And the kicker here is that wood boards, no cheesemaker just, nilly-willy ages cheese on boards. These wooden boards are sanitized. They are cleaned. They're often heated in kilns to kill the bacteria. Cheesemakers take this seriously. It's not something that we just discovered. They've been doing it for hundreds of years.
Well, the FDA is taking on more of a prevention role when it comes to food safety instead of reacting to an outbreak. They're trying to stop things like listeria is their main worry here. Is there a case to be made for better safe than sorry? If we've got these porous materials that could harbor listeria, maybe we should look for other ways to do this?
Well, as far as I know, and I've read a lot of studies, I don't know of any cheese that's been recalled specifically because of being aged on wood. That if there's a problem in cheese, it's typically not because of the material it's aged on. It's because something else happened to that milk long before it got placed on that wooden board. So just because there are studies, actually there was a study that came out of the Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research in 2013 where they decided that based on the beneficial effects of wood boards on cheese ripening, that the use of wood boards does not present any sort of danger as long as thorough cleaning procedures is followed. So I think we need to follow that.
So if there are listeria and other foodborne illness outbreaks out there, it's not the cheese?
Well, I mean, it's the cheese, but it's not the wooden board.
Okay. Now, I've seen some reaction pointing to the role of the Food Safety Modernization Act passed a couple years back. Is that part of the story?
I think so, because FDA is taking very much a preventive versus a reactive stance on food safety now under FSMA, as it's lovingly called. Mm-hmm. But I think in this case, their proactive stance is very much misplaced. Science is not on their side in this case. I think they are really interpreting studies incorrectly. And I'm hoping in time that other folks in the FDA will read these same studies and will hopefully clarify the position to going back to letting state departments of agriculture and state safety inspectors like they are now and to enforce the rule.
Well, you mentioned you hope that in time they do that, but is this federal law in effect right now for everyone?
It is. But what I'm hearing from state departments of health is that they are still they're not going to be closing down cheese factories, first of all. Nobody wants to lose the economic presence of dairy, especially here in Wisconsin. I think we're kind of in a wait-and-see mode. I know that the FDA is crafting a press release further clarifying their position on this issue. So I think everybody, from consumer to cheesemaker to the folks at state departments of ag are waiting for further clarification from the FDA.
Some of the cheeses aged on these on wood, they're multi-year processes, aren't they?
They are. I mean, some of the most famous cheeses in America are aged on wood. We have here in Wisconsin, Pleasant Ridge Reserve from Uplands Cheese. It's a triple Best in Show winner from the American Cheese Society. It's been aged on wooden boards from its beginning. Likewise, for current U.S. champion cheese, Marika Gouda from Thorpe. And then cheeses, in Vermont, Cabot Classbound. Basically name a famous cheese from America that's won major awards, and it's been aged on wood.
But I wonder, since it can take years to age some of these cheeses, is that making it difficult for cheesemakers to plan? Should I start a new batch now that might be a 1 or 3 or 5 year process, knowing that maybe I'll have to stop midway through?
That's a really good question. I suppose a lot of cheesemakers are wondering that. But the other thing I'm hearing from cheesemakers is that they have been very compliant with everything else that FDA has handed down to them through FSMA. They've been very compliant with increased regulation, increased inspection, increased critical control safety point plans. But I think a lot of them are going to say enough's enough with this decision, and I think the FDA is going to have a fight on their hands.
I know it's early in the reaction stage, but are cheesemakers, maybe even state officials, planning to pick up that fight?
I hope so. There's a lot of talk amongst the industry of trade organizations partnering with cheesemakers and even consumers. There's already been a petition filed with the White House to retract this clarification from the FDA. So this is interesting because this seems to be an issue that is binding consumers, the organizations, cheesemakers, and even politicians together. It's one of those issues that everybody loves their cheese and nobody wants it to go away.
Jeannie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jeannie Carpenter. She's director of the Wisconsin Artisan Cheesemaker Guild. And we've had a lot of response to this issue on Facebook already at the Central Time Facebook page.
That's right. Jennifer has said, remarkably bad decision, one that could be particularly damaging for Wisconsin's economy.
And Beldar writes, good Lord, our cheese already loses the taste test when compared with cheese from the UK. The FDA isn't going to let up till we're all sitting around discussing the finer qualities of Velveeta over a glass of Morgan David. Well, thanks for those Facebook comments. And you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts as well. When we think of archaeology, we may think of remote explorations and digging in out-of-the-way deserts and jungles around the world.
But an ongoing project here in Wisconsin has made some surprising discoveries under people's lawns in Trempealeau. Danielle Benden is with the Trempealeau Archaeology Project. She's senior academic curator for the UW-Madison Department of Anthropology. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what have you and your team found so far in Trempealeau?
Well, we have been up just for a couple of days. This is our first, or our second day of the 2014 summer season. We've been working in the area for the last, I've been working in the area for the last 15 years and more intensively in the last 4 years or so. And what we've uncovered is, looks to be a colony of people that archaeologists call Mississippians who came up from the site of Cahokia, which is near St. Louis, Missouri, about 1,000 years ago, and settled right here in Wisconsin.
So that's quite a journey from the St. Louis area, Cahokia, to up near Trempealeau. How did they get there?
So we think they presumably came via dugout canoe up the Mississippi River, and I stress the word up the Mississippi River.
Right, it's against the current.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that go down the Mississippi River, but there's not very many people who would make a 700 river mile journey up the river, crossing several sets of rapids, and it's a really long journey. They really wanted to get to Trempealeau.
And do we know the why? I guess that's the big question when you look at a journey like that.
Yes, these are the kinds of questions we're asking. Why did they leave Cahokia? Why did they come to Trempealeau? It looks like they didn't really stop anywhere in between. Of course, they had to stop to camp, from time to time. But it doesn't look like they stopped and set up shop anywhere else in between. So what we have is, it looks almost like a moonshot. They leave Cahokia. We think that they knew that they were headed to Trempealeau, and the question is why. Well, we have been trying to answer those questions in the last few years working here, and we're continuing to do some excavation to uncover the answers. We think it has actually something to do with the geology of the area. So if your listeners or you have been to the Trempealeau area, it's very unique geologically. We're in the unglaciated driftless area of Wisconsin in the upper Mississippi River Valley, just along the Mississippi River. And Trempealeau is famous for Trempealeau Mountain, which is a spit of land that is completely surrounded by water. And actually, the word Trempealeau is a French word, and if you translate it loosely, it means Trempealeau Mountain is La Montagne qui Trempealeau, which is the mountain whose foot is bathed in water or surrounded completely by water. And that's unique because in the entire 2,400-mile stretch of the Mississippi River, it is the only place where you get a remnant bluff sitting surrounded completely by water. So undoubtedly it was a landmark going back since the first people arrived in Wisconsin 12 or 13,000 years ago. And presumably Mississippian people who came from Cahokia knew about it 1,000 years ago when they left Cahokia and came to set up a colony here in Trempealeau.
Oh, and so what have you found so far, and where are you digging?
A lot of, I was listening to the opening, and you're exactly right. When a lot of people think of archaeology sites, they think of faraway, distant places, and what we're literally digging in people's backyards, because the modern village of Trempealeau is situated over a 1,000-year-old village set up by Cahokians. We have yet to draw a line around the extent of the site, because every time we do work in somebody's yard and put a shovel in the ground, we're finding more and more things. So we find things like the remnants and sometimes almost complete parts of pottery vessels that these people make, and they make a very distinctive kind of pottery that is painted red with really beautiful decorations. We find their stone tools. We find their houses. So they build very distinctive houses that are different than the local people would have been building. They make these rectangular-shaped wall trench structures, or what they're called. So they're kind of semi-subterranean, which is great, keeps you warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer. And so, you know, we're basically, what we see is it looks like they literally brought everything with them. There is clay in the hills around here to make pots. There's stone, there's tool to make stone, stone material to make stone tools. But they're not really using the local material. They're bringing everything with them. And so when you look at the literature of colonization and colonies, you know, when Europeans come to the New World, what do? They bring everything with them because they want to make sure that they have the stuff that is part of their cultural, you know, heritage and their cultural, upbringing.
Well, it also sounds like they intended to stay for a while. How long were they there?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. So far, they're here for a very short period of time. It looks to be just about 50 years or so, and then they're gone. And that's another question is why? Why did they come and set up shop here and then leave 50 years later? And we don't know the answer to that question yet, but we do know that we think that it's a pretty elite group of people who traveled up the river and settled here. And we know that because at Cahokia and nearby sites, when you find this kind very distinctive kinds of pottery that we're finding in our excavations in Trempealeau, it's associated with really elite residences. So just like any big city, which, you know, Cahokia was a city, it was, you know, roughly 20,000 people living there about 1,000 years ago, you have various socioeconomic statuses within the group of people, right? So you have those that are wealthier than others and those that are a little bit poor. And you see in the poorer residences, not everybody has access to the nicer, it's sort of like fine china, right? So not everybody has access to the nicer kinds of things. And what we're finding up here in Trempealeau is pretty much almost all of this really the nicer made stuff that archaeologists call fineware. And so we think it's a small group of elites that are leaving Cahokia and coming up and setting up shop in Trempealeau. I think that it's a relatively small group of people, and we can kind of tell that judging by how many people would live in a house and based on the number of houses we found. Something also really important is that Mississippian people build flat rectangular mounds, and they're all made of basket loads of dirt. So at Cahokia, the largest of these flat-top mounds is called Monk's Mound, and it's 100 feet tall, and it's 15 acres at the base. So
Wow. For
your listeners who are familiar, they've been to a football game at Camp Randall, that would fill Camp Randall, and it's all made of dirt. We have three platform mounds, and actually we're working, there's a fourth one in the village of Trempealeau. So there's four platform mounds in Trempealeau. They're not nearly that size. They're much smaller, but they're bringing everything with them, even this idea of building their platform mounds.
Now, it sounds as though the locals in Trempealeau are getting involved. It's just not archaeology students and scientists. How are the residents of Trempealeau getting involved in all this?
Yeah, they absolutely are. So this project that I'm doing is sponsored by the Baldwin Wisconsin Ideas Endowment and also by the Morgridge Center for Public Service at UW-Madison. And, you know, it's essentially this idea of advancing the Wisconsin idea where, you know, the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state. It's how can we as members of UW-Madison and not just faculty and staff but students go out into communities across the state and across the country and the world for that matter and provide our expertise and help out the local, communities and engage them and work collaboratively. And so this project does just that. So we've got the excavations, and I've got 12 UW-Madison students with me now, and they're taking up my archaeology field methods course. And we also will have members of the public come and excavate with us. And that is just so much fun, not only for our students and the residents to get to know each other, but also just it really provides a sense of ownership for the local community to be able to uncover something that is 1,000 years old. It's been 1,000 years since anybody's touched that. That's really incredible sensation for us as archaeologists, but also for the members of the community. It's literally in their backyard. So that's sort of one way we're engaging them. And then the second way we'll engage them is through the rest of the next 2 years when I teach a curation methods course at Madison. And that's what do we do with everything once it's been excavated? How do we care for it? How do we manage it? How do we use it for interpretation?
And so, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. But Danielle, thank you so much for joining us. It's fascinating.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Danielle Benden, Senior Academic Curator for the UW-Madison Department of Anthropology, talking about the ongoing Trempealeau Archaeology Project. There have been growing calls to end what some describe as an era of mass incarceration in the United States, with over 2 million Americans imprisoned and a higher incarceration rate than any other developed country. Some critics, including our next guest, say we need to make a change.
Stan Stojkovich is with us now. He's professor of criminal justice and dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is prompted by a letter we saw of yours to the New York Times. You're responding to an editorial on mass incarceration, and you write, "I believe that the concept of redemption must play a much larger role." Have we lost sight of the idea of redemption in our crime and punishment system?
I think in the last 30 years in particular, redemption as a concept, as a correctional concept, is not necessarily a new thing. The idea of prison was to allow people to atone for their sins early on and ultimately come back into society. But somewhere at the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century, we lost complete sight of that. And so the mass incarceration movement was really designed to forget about redemption and to simply be retributive or punishment-oriented. And that has had enormously negative consequences on our society.
Is it just punishment incorporated or oriented or safety? Having people locked up means they're not out committing crimes.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the contribution of prison to ultimately long-term safety is there, but it's not the only thing. The fact is that at some point in time, you're going to have to make decisions, since 99% of all people in prison are going to eventually walk out. The question becomes, how do you want them to walk out, and walk out to what? What's really available to them? We are now seeing across this country, Wisconsin included, massive reentry efforts, because we've got people who are sentenced under laws back in the 1980s, 1990s. They're now coming out of prison. Many of them have nothing. They don't have any skills. But there are people who are in prison, and regardless of this sort of, and in spite of this terrible conditions that they're under, they still are able to improve themselves and have shown redemption. And so redemption is a concept that requires behavioral change that can be documented. And I think that it's about time that we really focus our energies on something like that, as opposed to simply being retributive.
And you were just describing the impacts this has on people locked up. You also write that our system of mass incarceration is crushing our society spiritually. How so?
Well, what we're doing is we're looking at people only in one light. Now, I know that's difficult for people to look in a different light, particularly someone who's a hardened criminal. But the fact of the matter is, redemption and forgiveness is the essence of what many people in this country believe to be their spiritual faith, whether it's an organized religion or it's some spirituality. The idea of redemption and forgiveness is actually very positive. It's a human condition that says, I recognize the wrong you did to me, but I also recognize that you have an opportunity to change that. Now, there are many prisoners who don't avail themselves of those opportunities, and corrections officials can tell you about them ad nauseum. But the fact of the matter is, we have large numbers of people who are sitting in our prisons who have taken every program, every initiative, have educated themselves, and now are saying to them, I'm ready to come back. I'm ready for a break. Can you give me one? We have historically said, at least in recent history, the last 30 years, no, we don't even want to consider that. And I think that that's very short-sighted, let alone economically and socially devastating on our state budgets.
Let's follow that economic point up. What is the impact of the rising levels of incarceration over the last few decades?
Well, you can do comparative, and I know that a lot of people in Wisconsin hate this comparative analysis, but the fact of the matter is, Minnesota does it right. And Minnesota started doing it right in the early 1970s, passing a Community Corrections Act, which really gave incentives to people to keep people in their counties and to work with them. It is estimated by the Wisconsin Taxpayer Alliance that since the early 1970s up to about 2010, Minnesota saved about $3 billion. Now think about that. Think of that enormity. Minnesota and Wisconsin are very alike, demographically, socially, politically in some cases, but they're very similar. But we chose to incarcerate large numbers of people. What could a city of Milwaukee, for example, where 50% of all prisoners in the state come from, what could they have done with $3 billion? Or even a portion of that money on road repair, education, health care? This is money and opportunities lost, huge opportunity costs. And the assumption that many people hold of the prisoners are really they can't really provide anything, is blatantly false. There's enough evidence out there to say if we structure correct programming, use good assessment procedures, we can do things with people. And I think at the end of the day, forgiveness is economically viable and makes sense. And individuals, if you start to think this argument through, it's much more powerful kind of argument that I think has broad support, but we need to make people aware. And that's really my intention in the New York Times article.
And you mentioned the large portion of people in prisons coming from Milwaukee and probably concentrated, I imagine, in specific communities. What does mass incarceration do to those communities where a lot of people come into prison and then eventually come back out unready to do so?
It devastates these communities on all sorts of levels. It devastates them economically. It's taking away potential breadwinners, individuals who can pay taxes, as opposed to being a tax burden. Now, the assumption is that there is meaningful employment. That may be a questionable assumption, particularly in the city of Milwaukee now. But it, when it takes people out, it also affects social relationships. So, for example, African-American men who are disproportionately overrepresented in Wisconsin prisons, 12-13% nationally, and in Wisconsin a little less, but 50% of all admissions into our prisons. And from specific zip codes, it destroys those communities. Women who want to marry men of their own color, of their own race and ethnicity, have a much more narrow, smaller pool to choose from because many of these men are winding up in prison. And in Milwaukee's case, it's horrific, the impact. So there are all sorts of levels, but at the core, it spiritually reduces us. It takes us to a point where we ultimately are looking at another human being in a way that's defined as all negative, and that just doesn't make any sense moving forward. And I don't think right now, most states, Wisconsin included, have understood this. We can't afford this prolonged mass incarceration. The numbers are just too high.
The numbers are high. Is the public aware of this? Do people know this, or did it kind of happen gradually and out of sight, out of mind, to where it doesn't feel different if you're not directly connected to the prison system?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I have been speaking about this for 30 years. And it's not just me. There's a lot of people out there. There are church people. There are family members. There are politicians. There are all sorts of groups who are out there have been talking about this for many, many years, that this is a train wreck. Years ago, when I asked specific people in the legislature, when they signed Truth in Sentencing into effect on January 1, 2000, I asked them, have you done an impact statement on this? And their response was incredulous. Was, what do you mean? We don't need that. We know it works. What works? What you only thing you know is you're going to fill up the prisons. And this is not something that's going to have a long-term beneficial effect. It may have a short-term political benefit to certain politicians, but it does not have the long-term support of citizens, because citizens do expect people to be held accountable, but they also expect corrections and the rest of society to do something with those people so that when they get out, they don't go back. That's the side of the equation that oftentimes politicians forget. But citizens are very clear in our opinion polls and our opinion research about correctional efforts. So there's a lot of issues associated with this, and it's obviously complicated, but I think we really need to start thinking differently.
Briefly, in Wisconsin, there was an early release program for geared at nonviolent offenders, getting them out of the prison system earlier, viewed as a cost saver, a change of administration, and that ended. Did you see that as a good first step? Were you disappointed when it changed?
I was disappointed because that was a good first step, and there was no empirical evidence. In fact, my review of the people who were left out, who actually got out sooner, and many of them got out a week or 2 weeks sooner than they would have anyway. This would have had no particular impact in terms of crime and recidivism. Many of them were being successful. Now, granted, the program was early. It didn't last long. But when the Walker administration came in, they basically gutted it, and they ended it. And that was a huge mistake. It was a step in the wrong direction, particularly if you're trying to send a message to these people, we're going to hold you accountable through the prison sentence that we're going to impose upon you, but we also have an expectation that you do something with yourself, and we will provide those resources. We haven't done that either, by the way. We've done a really bad, poor job, I should say, in doing that. So, again, complicated, but I think we need to really rethink things.
People who supported that change, ending that early release program, and probably people who work in the prison systems, I think, might say, yeah, sounds nice, Stan, this is wishful thinking. These are hardened guys. They're criminals. It's very hard to consider releasing them and think about the public safety impact they're going to have.
Well, then they would be misguided. Because the fact of the matter is some of them are hardened. They make up 5-10% of the prison population. Some of them we have to control. Some need to be in prison for a long time. I will not deny that ever. I'm a former prison worker, so I understand that. But the fact of the matter is most of our people are in medium security. They're classified as medium security. They don't require these kind of long, protracted sentences, particularly on the drug offenses. We can do something better, smarter, and more efficient, and ultimately have a long-term benefit, not only to them and their families and society, but also in the long run to future generations. We are saddling this state with enormous debt around correctional efforts that clearly do not show any kind of improvement in what we're doing right now, which is simply locking people up and throwing away the key. So I always say to those people, they're misdirected. If you look at the evidence doesn't support the assertions they put forward.
We're talking to Stan Stojkovic, criminal justice professor at UW-Milwaukee. He says we're locking too many people up for too long, and we need to embrace concepts of redemption and forgiveness and move away from an era of mass incarceration.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think we are locking too many people up in the United States? And do you agree with our guests that we should have more of a focus on redemption, rehabilitation, and forgiveness? Or do you think that people in prison need to do their time to keep the rest of us safe? Call with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about prisons and redemption. Our guest is UW-Milwaukee criminal justice professor Stan Stojkovic. He says we lock too many people up for too long, and it's hurting the inmates, the communities they come from, and our nation as a whole.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on mass incarceration in the United States. Do we lock too many people up for too long? Or are we following the right path despite the expense? 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Michael on the line in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to speak from the viewpoint of the inmate. I was an inmate in Milwaukee or Wisconsin prison system for over 3 years as a multiple drunk driving offender. And I went in there with someone who had a substance abuse or an alcohol problem, and I got absolutely no rehabilitation. And during that time, I lost my house. I lost relationships that I had cultivated over years. I lost the relationship with my 9-year-old daughter. I went into debt, 3 years in debt of not being able to pay bills. The state paid $32,000 a year to incarcerate me, and I got nothing out of it. And I can tell you from being in there with other drunk drivers at Prairie du Chien Correctional that they didn't get anything out of it. It embittered a lot of people. You come out so broken, so messed up. You lost everything you ever had before, and so many people just they end up so much worse off. I could have, when my attorney asked if we could do Huber, I could have continued to pay my child support. Now I'm 3+ years behind in child support. That didn't help my daughter or her mother. It hurt them tremendously. I could have continued to pay child support, continued to pay taxes. I could have kept my house. I lost so much.
Michael, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, and good luck to you and coming back from that. Stan, he tells a lot of that story. First, no rehab he saw in a correctional facility for drunk driving offenses.
Well, you know, rehabilitation and the devotion of resources in an institutional setting is somewhere between 10 to 15% of the correctional dollar. We don't put the money where we say we want to. And some states, like California, for example, Texas, if you can imagine, New York, Pennsylvania, they have really redirected a lot of funding because there is good evidence that good programming, good assessment can have an impact on changing people's lives. We have the technical skill in many cases. Now, I'm not here to offer a panacea solution. I don't have one. But we can do it a heck of a lot better and save a heck of a lot of misery. And by the way, the distinction between my approach and, let's say, a public safety approach is false. My approach will make you more safe. will ultimately make society more safe. We'll have fewer people than the previous caller experiencing the kinds of conditions. He's one of thousands who've come out of Wisconsin prisons in the last 15 to 20 years really with nothing. And then we expect these people to succeed. It's no wonder that a vast majority of them fail.
Less than nothing, anyway. Not only no money in debt, but without the social connections that might help someone get going again.
Well, also, at a more fundamental existential level, they're spiritually dead. They are completely, their human spirit, which is the worst cost in the long run. If you want to destroy a human spirit, you consider current incarceration and its impact, not only on that person, as the caller said, the family, society on the whole. What is the purpose of that? I say in my editorial, at some point, we've got to start talking about then incarceration becoming simply cruelty.
We'll go back to
our... that really what we're all about? I don't think so.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Jervis on the line in Milwaukee. Jervis, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I didn't hear the other caller, but I guess I had the opportunity with working with Restorative Justice with Professor Gene Getzke out of Marquette University. I had an opportunity to actually sit and talk with the individual who murdered my father several years ago, and a couple of other times I'm going in, and I don't think people really appreciate the fact that these people who get in prison are really caught up in a moment, and they're forced to pay for the rest of their lives for an act that they committed. And they might have done a few other things, but the bottom line is a lot of them don't even realize the impact of their actions on individuals that they perpetrated these things against. And when the person who was who you're speaking to, the professor from UWM, talked about our religion of forgiveness, you know, my first thing that I tell people when I go there is that, you know, after reading a book by Dr. Martin Luther King, Strength to Love, is he has a sermon on that says, Father, forgive them for they know not what they do, as Jesus hung on the cross. And I don't think people really understand that a lot of these individuals don't even realize what they've done. And they, you know, until they're confronted with an individual like me or a few others, then there's a softness that you see in these people that comes across.
Jervis,
and it's very powerful.
You met your father's murderer, you said. Were you able to forgive him?
Yes. I mean, I had worked through this process for several years, but then when the opportunity to come came, I actually sat across the table from him and we talked for about 2 or 3 hours, and I had forgiven him before then, and at the same time I forgave him, I have to understand it. Now he has to go forward with that, knowing that he has that, and understand that from my standpoint and from my family's standpoint, what he did was wrong, but now go forth with your life and do something with it, you know? And try not to do any more harm to anybody else. And I mean, I know that might sound very, utopic or whatever the case that we're looking for, but I honestly believe that that's what we're supposed to. We're supposed to place hope in other people.
Jervis, thank you so much for sharing your story. Very powerful. Stan, we have to forgive, he says, and then the offender has to take that forgiveness and do something with it.
Yeah, my idea of redemption is I just don't forgive you for forgiveness sake. I forgive you because you've changed behaviorally. You've shown me that you really have atoned. You've taken on the responsibility of dealing with your children, dealing with your drug addiction, getting some education. That, to me, reflects redemption. It's a two-way street. Where restoration stops, redemption begins. Restoration is to try to make the process back into equilibrium. I want to go beyond that. I want to say I want people to be forgiven and ultimately prove that they deserve forgiveness, because not everybody does. So there's responsibility on both ends here, and it's really moving forward. And if we don't have that kind of philosophy, I think that we are in a bad place given the numbers that we have, and just the projecting those numbers and their costs are just horrific, both in human costs as well as financial costs.
Thanks so much for that call. We'll go to Nathan now on the line in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Nathan?
My question is, it seems very nice and well, but what about the victims? You know, the victims go through a lot, and it seems sometimes the punishment doesn't equal the crime.
The punishment is insufficient, you're saying, to the enormity of the crime?
Absolutely.
Well, I can tell you this. That's not borne out by the evidence. If anything, the evidence suggests the exact opposite. The punishment is over. It's disproportionate in many cases. You must remember, too, we know a lot about victims, and I would never minimize victims in this process. The victims are very important, but at the end of the day, what you don't hear is victims saying, I want to move on with this, and I got to get on with my life. I've been devastated in some cases. Most crimes are not murders. They're not sexual assaults. There are a lot of those, don't get me wrong, but most crimes are not that serious. And the fact of the matter is, the question is, when do you use imprisonment and when do you not? Forgiveness and redemption is really about the idea of caring about everyone. Not only myself as a victim and a family member of a victim, but I'm also caring in a larger context. I'm caring about what's the best interest going forward for everyone involved. And I know that takes a lot of patience, but I'll tell you, victim research indicates most victims are interested in that. They want something. That's why, again, politicians tend to say, we simply want to lock people up. That's half the equation. Half the equation is accountability through locking people up. The other half is doing something with them. Most people who are reasonable understand that. And I'm telling you now, we don't have the luxury to think any different anymore. We just don't have the funds, and we don't have the wherewithal. And the impact on these communities, particularly large communities in like Milwaukee, are devastating.
Do you see the conversation changing, especially on the drug war? Are politicians maybe starting to be less ready to be tough on crime?
Well, I think what you're seeing is people trying to be more smart on crime. I mean, take, for example, Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, very conservative, the man who led the Congress in the 1990s, right? He is leading a group of people who are trying to look at imprisonment as listen, we got to make better choices. And he's right. I may not agree politically with him on all sorts of issues, but on this issue, I'm in total unanimity and agreement with him. We've got to think smarter about how do we utilize our prison system. How do we utilize corrections? Also, we have to think about, again, spiritually, what does this say about us? All right, if we lead the world in mass incarceration. And, you know, the devil's in the details. Earlier you said 2 million people in prison. Well, it's 2.3 million, but about 1.7 are in prison, and 600,000 are in jails, and they're not the same institutions. Most of us have to become more educated about what these systems really are first, and then we can be knowledgeable about moving forward. But I think across the political spectrum now, whether they're being forced by a court, like in California's case, Supreme Court stepped in on their overcrowding and said, you've got to release X number of prisoners.
We'll have to leave it there. That's Stan Stojkovic, professor of criminal justice.